When you have insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. How do you know you're not overpaying? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a technology company that securely connects with your insurance and reviews your claims for overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds, and Marjorie Taylor Greene now sits on the Homeland Security Committee. We have a very interesting show for you today. Representative Eric Swalwell from California stops by to update us on the mess that is the United States Congress. Then we'll talk to Alex Theodorides about how Republicans are ignoring all polling about their lack of popularity. But first, we have the host of The Time of Monsters, the nation's G-tier. Welcome back to Fast Politics, G-tier.
Always good to be here.
So happy to have you. America, we pride ourselves on our ridiculousness, but I feel like we may have hit a new low. Or high?
In what? I'm trying to think. There's like a dozen stories you could be referring to.
The photos of people in the House trying to beat each other up.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was something. Although, I mean, to maybe offer a reassurance, not quite pre-Civil War level yet, because, of course, famously before the Civil War, there was like a senator from, or congressman, I think, from either South Carolina or Mississippi who beat up an abolitionist on the floor of the House. You know, we're not quite there yet, but violence in a parliament is never good. I think maybe the good thing about it is that it's actually inter-Republican.
Right. Republican on Republican violence.
Yeah, yeah. Republican on Republican violence is, well, you know, I say let them sort it out.
Yeah, I mean, it does remind me of this sort of Civil War. Didn't you have senators caning each other on the floor?
Yeah, yeah, no, famously, yeah. There was a very famous incident and people, you know, challenging each other to duels. And yes, that's right. Yeah, I mean, I don't think we're quite at the Civil War stage yet. But on the other hand, I don't know. I mean, I have to like always do a check. I think you probably saw the story this morning from New Mexico of the failed candidate, Solomon Pina, I believe is his name. And he was trying to shoot up Democrats and hiring people to shoot up Democrats, as I understand.
Yeah, as someone who spends a lot of time in New Mexico, I will say there was an important caveat in the in one of the first reported articles, which I think was from a local newspaper, which said something effective like, well, not entirely clear, because as you know, New Mexico has a very high murder and shooting rate. They had to make sure that this was not just like random.
Sure. Yeah. No, I think we kind of have, you know, that proviso. And I think there were periods in American history where political violence was much higher than now. I mean, I actually think, you know, like the 1850s, like, you know, there was like actually a lot of violence, things like Bleeding Kansas. And even in the 1960s and 1970s, I mean, you look at the number of bombings and shootings and assassinations, most famously, it was like at a higher level than we have now. On the other hand, I don't think we should be complacent. Right. I mean, there's a kind of, new political violence. I mean, I think one way to think about it is, I think Trump didn't really ever create anything, but he's created new permission structures for people to, open up some of the bottled anger that they have inside of them. I think we're seeing the consequences of some of that. I don't know. I mean, I think it's worrying. I've been trying to be a little bit more optimistic. I mean, I do think we've had three elections since 2016, right? Like 2018, 2020, 2022. And I think the Democrats are getting better, actually, over time at, like, foregrounding the problems with Republican extremism and using it for its advantages. And I think that, like, in a lot of places, it's worked to their advantage. I mean, and honestly, like, if the New York State Democratic Party weren't this, like, amazing contraption of ineptness and corruption, I think Nancy Pelosi could still be speaker, or Hakeem Jeffries could be speaker. It was pretty close.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I mean, I also think that it's like a situation where you have the FBI has gotten much better at stopping some of these crimes, right? So, like with Governor Gretchen Whitmer, you're seeing, like that could have really gotten to be a very messy and ugly situation where they foiled the kidnapping. So I do think it's sort of interesting. And then you have the far right super mad at the FBI and saying, like, the FBI is like this tool of the woke globalist establishment. I mean, so we are, I mean, I don't think anyone on the left thinks that the FBI is on their side.
No. The famously left-wing FBI. I mean, it is interesting. I forget what it was, but Trump had a sort of acronym for the FBI, like, forever barging in or something like that. It actually reminded me of, there are some mafiosos, thinking the maybe Gotti family, who said FBI is forever bothering Italians. So I think Trump has some of that ethos.
It's funny because Pete Strick explained to me the sort of how Trumpy all of these law enforcement agencies are. And he had been at the FBI and he had actually been very involved in training a lot of FBI agents. And he said that sort of the most Trumpy was the Secret Service and the border control. Those people are like very Trumpy. And then you have, sort of lesser degree, as you sort of get to be more of a kind of, I don't want to sound like a snob here, but as you get to be people who are like, more trained, they get sort of less and less Trumpy. I just thought that was pretty interesting.
I mean, we don't talk enough about the Secret Service. I mean, there's a couple of things. I mean, there's actually like reporting out there that Biden is, concerned about the Secret Service and doesn't quite trust them.
Would you? I would not.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big thing. And I think, there was that thing with on January 6th where I forget the exact details. Maybe you can remember them, but like there seemed to be like Pence was worried about the Secret Service as well.
Well, and also Pence, remember they wanted him to get in that car and he wouldn't get in the car. I mean,
that's what I'm thinking about. Yeah.
There were so many machinations. Again, like we don't want to sound conspiratorial, certainly not, but there were a lot of things that the January 6th committee was unable to thread the needle on, but had any of them been proven, they would have been pretty shocking.
I mean, there's reported evidence out there that suggests that at least part of the Secret Service is compromised and that there are people, including Pence and Biden, who are a bit concerned about this. That's an area of concern. So none of it is good.
Right.
Within limits, I think that some of the political response has been good. I mean, I think one thing one can sort of talk about is the January 6th report and January 6th. I mean, I think that the January 6th commission was very important. And I think that, and I was somebody who was kind of a bit cautious and concerned about it because I wasn't sure that, this would actually win people over. But I think that in some ways, a lot of Republican election denialists losing in the midterms was due to the January 6th commission keeping this issue in the foreground, keeping it alive in people. And one can have concerns or critiques, right. Like the New Yorker has a big critique from Jill Lepore, a very distinguished historian about, you know, how the January 6th report doesn't like quite go into all the background and detail. And, you know, I mean, I think that's fair. I mean, I think it's very much designed to be a sort of prosecutorial brief.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I think other people can take up, you know, the slack of what's missing in the January 6th commission. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would urge listeners to like resist, you know, giving into pessimism on all this stuff. Like, I think it's a much more mixed record. I mean, certainly the problem is any sort of like law enforcement solution to this is only a partial solution. And that's for two reasons. One of which is that I think the GOP can always weaponize partisanship and both sides of them. And they can take like, oh yeah, of course, you know, Trump took secret documents, but you know, Biden had documents in his garage too. That's all they need. I mean, like, I know we can point out all the differences between Biden and Trump, but like they have their talking point now, right? They have the point that can politically neutralize this issue of Trump. And the other thing with like law enforcement solutions is that they don't get to the sort of political issue. I mean, the political issue is, you know, Trump has activated this far right element, which has existed for decades, which has existed, you know, going back to Reagan and going back to the John Birch Society, you know, going back to McCarthyism, as you know from your family history.
Right.
Trump has activated that and has made it much more powerful in the Republican Party. And that's the political problem. And I think there are limits to, you know, one wants the FBI investigating crimes and potential assassination attempts. But there's, you know, like I would insist that like a law enforcement solution is only a partial solution. And that ultimately there's a political solution, which is, you know, Democrats have to keep foregrounding this stuff and using it as a weapon to defeat Republicans.
Yeah. Oh, no question. And I mean, I think that is a really good point. I mean, Republicans have been so brilliant about, for example, like this, they've been continually saying, and I don't mean brilliant because this is not a compliment, but, you know, they've said things like the army is very woke. The army is too woke. The army is all woke PC. And what they're doing is not that they think the army is woke, or maybe they do, but more likely than not, they don't. But it's more of a way of trying to push back against any kind of sensitivity that the army may be, you know, being trained to have. So it's almost like, I wonder, with a lot of these Republican talking points, they're almost as if they're sort of, you know, they see a possible in. And so there's a kind of pushback before there's even something to push back against.
Yeah, I would actually go a bit further than that. I mean, I think this whole issue of the army being woke goes back to a very specific thing, which is after January 6th, even before then, but it really became an issue after January 6th, there was a lot of concern about infiltration in the American military, of having, you know, these MAGA Trumpists in the military. And we know Trump tried to put his own people in the Pentagon,
right,
including people who are very much part of January 6th. And there was a perfectly justified concern, you know, not only among Democrats in the Biden administration, but within the Pentagon itself about this. And there was like a sort of concerted effort to find these people and to purge it. Like, you cannot have people who would be on board with a coup in military positions. And I think that people like Tucker Carlson, you know, took up the woke military stuff as a way of arguing against that, as a way of trying to resist any attempt to keep the army non-political and to keep, you know, these kind of pro-coup ideas out of the military. I mean, I think that's my understanding of it. And I think if one looks back at like when Tucker Carlson really started talking about this stuff, and also some of the people he was quoting, which were people who were basically let go of the military, discharged from the military because they had pro-coup sentiments, I think that's the issue at stake there. And I mean, I think the Biden administration has done it more low-key than, say, Bolsonaro in Brazil. I mean,
right. I was actually just about to bring up Brazil, but yes, go on.
I mean, Brazil, I mean, you know, listeners should understand, has a much more...
They're much more coup-friendly, yes.
Yeah. I mean, they have a any democratically elected president of Brazil, I think, has to worry more about coups, because they had military dictatorship, you know, in living memory in the 1980s, and they've had a military that's been willing to intervene. Sometimes with the green lighting of the United States, I should add. They've had a military that has been willing to overthrow democratic governments. So, you know, Bolsonaro has gone pretty hard in terms of, like, you know, purging the pro-coup faction in the military, which definitely in Brazil there was. I think those are the kind of stakes here. I mean, I think in America it's a little bit, we're not quite at the Brazil situation yet, and I think it's a little bit low-key. The other aspect I would kind of put out sociologically, that's kind of worth thinking about, is the average age of, like, people coming into the military is always going to be around 21, right? like the soldiers that you're getting in, that you're wanting to be played, they were going to be very young, right? And so the people that are coming in the military were all born in this century. As terrifying as that, and we're born after 9/11, right? And if you talk to, like, you know, people that are born in the century, then their whole view, and some of them are Republicans, but their whole view of social issues, trans stuff, of gay stuff, is very different than Fox News viewership, which is like
in their
over
80s.
65.
Yeah.
So of course, if you're, like, you know, a Fox News viewer or Tucker Carlson trying to cater to those viewers, then yeah, you know, there's something where the military, you know, just for recruitment purposes, just for, like, you know, like trying not to get people to join the military, is going to put out ads and have a different discourse and dialogue than, you know, Fox News is.
Right.
It's just, there's literally like 40 to 50 year difference between the people who join the army and the people who watch Fox News.
It is interesting to me, though, that in Brazil, they didn't fuck around. They just arrested everyone. I'm not saying that the Brazilian law enforcement was right and the American law enforcement was wrong, but it's an interesting data point. And if you think about all the times we've seen since during the Trump administration, people with long guns and AR-15s going into state, you saw that in Michigan, they all went into the state house. I do wonder how much of this had to do with just the worry that a lot of these people had guns.
Yeah, I think there's a worry that they have guns. There's also, I mean, in America, you know, your point earlier about, you know, how Trumpy various law enforcement could be and, you know, like how you can enforce it. I mean, the Illinois gun law, I think, is a kind of interesting, you know, data point as well. Like, just in terms of you can pass a, you know, a gun law, but there are going to be sheriffs in rural areas that won't enforce it. And I think some of the same issues come up here. Like, you know, like, do you fully have all of law enforcement on board? It is worrying. I think Lula in Brazil took the right approach. You know, he has legitimate worries. And there was, like, you know, like, even before the coup, like, leading up to the election, there were, like, you know, pro-Bolsonaro law enforcement and army that were trying to prevent people from voting, right? And I think that's one reason why the election was as close as it was. I think it's a real issue and a real critique that's playing out in the Democratic Party. Is the Biden administration doing enough? Is someone like Merrick Garland, is he, like, you know, too afraid to, like, take some of the tough stances against Trump and against the sort of insurrectionist that one might need? I mean, yeah, I think those are all open questions. I put it in the political context again, though. I do want to say that I do think that there's a majority out there that is, like, horrified at the idea of insurrection and coups. And that, as you know, as long as you can keep hammering that point over, I think that, you know, that's, to me, the road to get to the right good place. That's the road to get to the
right, to get back to normal. But do you think, I mean, normal was not exactly, you know, but yes, to...
Yeah, even on that, go back to, you know, because you actually don't want to go back. But I mean, to get to a good place.
Yeah.
To get to, like, a better position. To get to, like, a marginalization.
Yeah, to sort of get out of this Trumpy anti-democracy stuff. But I just want to ask you, as we find ourselves in this, how much of, you know, this coup talk and this election was rigged? It didn't work this time, but how much of this is, like what we're talking about with the military, a sort of preemptive strike to help have a coup next time?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the more worrisome thing. And I think that the political reality is what one would hope, that is, the Republican Party, having lost in 2018, 2020, and 2020, and, you know, like, not lost, but having a very disappointing 2022, would moderate. And so far, that is really not happening. You know, and one sees it in sort of, you know, Kevin McCarthy and all the sort of the farce of his speakership. And the way that he's, like, you know, really empowered, you know, people who are actually, you know, to the right of Trump, I mean, I think that's what should be understood, that like the battle over the McCarthy speakership was not like moderates versus the far right, as a lot of the media presented it. That's absurd. Like McCarthy is on board with Marjorie Taylor Greene. You know, it was like the Trumpist right of versus McCarthy. And
the Trumpist right of McCarthy.
People who think that, yeah, the ultra-McCarthy. You know, there's an expression, more Catholic than the Pope, right? The ultra-montane Trumpist, where like Trump doesn't go far enough. The old joke about like, you know, finding Hitler in Brazil and says, you know, well, what would you regret? And he said, next time, no more Mr. Nice Guy.
Right, exactly. I mean, I don't want to laugh because it is actually just... Thank you so much, Jeet, here. I hope you will come back.
It's always a pleasure to be here.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
When you have health insurance, it's easy to think, I'm covered, no worries, right? Well, not so fast. What about your out-of-pocket costs? That can be a lot of money for you and your family. And if you're like me, you can't help but wonder, was I overbilled? You're not alone. It's estimated that over 50% of medical bills contain errors. Unless you're a billing expert, how do you know your medical bills are accurate? That's why I want to tell you about HealthLock. What is HealthLock? It's a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your family's insurance. When your medical claims come in, HealthLock technology reviews the claims for errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. HealthLock makes it easy to find and fix hidden errors, so you pay only what you owe. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. Bottom line, insurance alone isn't enough. HealthLock finds medical bill errors before you pay. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Eric Swalwell represents California's 14th district. Welcome to Fast Politics, Eric Swalwell.
Hey, Molly.
How are you?
Good, yeah. Crazy times here in Washington.
So let's talk about this new Congress. Some committee assignments have come out. Kevin McCarthy is the Speaker of the House for now.
If it was a law firm, it'd be called Insurrection LLC. You know, they're here to defend your rights if you were held accountable at the Capitol. It's kind of like a, you know, one of those TV commercials, I think. They're creating committees to defend their own rights because many of them are under investigation. And if you happen to be one of the 18 Republicans who represent a Biden district, I think Kevin McCarthy and his corrupt bargain to become speaker has written your political death certificate, because you're going to have to vote to defund the troops. You're going to learn everything about what was inside Hunter Biden's laptop, and you're going to do absolutely zero to take on the issues you ran on, you know, bringing down the costs of healthcare, groceries, gas, et cetera.
I want to ask you about motion to vacate, because one of the many things that Kevin McCarthy did to get this job that he may not have very long is a motion to vacate. Used to be under Nancy Pelosi, it was you had to be in leadership. Then it was five people. Now it's a one person motion. So does that mean that anyone at any time can call a new speakership race?
Yes. My prediction, Molly, is that you're going to see Marjorie Taylor Greene be the one who does it first.
Okay.
I'm not in the prediction business, but it just feels like we're hurtling toward that direction, because she, you know, has closely aligned herself with Speaker McCarthy so she can get her committee assignments back. But she's also promising everybody that Joe Biden and Secretary Mayorkas are all going to be impeached. And I think McCarthy is going to find pretty quickly that those 18 Republicans aren't going to want to go in that direction. And I can just see it now. So that's where the Republican, I think, House, you know, soap opera will take us.
You have stunned me. I'm rarely stunned, but you have stunned me. We see all these pictures of Marjorie Taylor Greene practically making out with Kevin McCarthy. And now you're saying she is going to be the Judas?
That's my prediction. Again, who knows who she's loyal to? But if you follow everything she's saying, she's saying that they're impeaching Biden, they're impeaching, you know, Mayorkas, they're going to expunge Trump, you know, for his impeachments. And I think you're going to start to see these 18 Biden Republicans pump the brakes. They started to suggest, you know, even with the rules package that they passed, that was going to be too far for them. A Republican from a deep, deep red district in Texas actually voted against the rules package because it was too far for him because of the troops defunding. So, no, I see that that's where this is going to be headed soon. And frankly, Molly, the contrast that I think most Americans are seeing is perhaps we should not have given these guys the majority, because we just had 2 years coming after, on the heels of the Trump administration, Democrats delivered and showed competence, and Republicans are just bringing chaos. That seems to be the state of play right now.
So I want to get back into this. The committee assignments are sort of slowly rolling out. These guys are super into targeting you. Can you talk a little bit about what happened last week with McCarthy?
Yeah, and McCarthy loves to, you know, reheat the leftovers when it comes to me. And just for your viewers' sake, what he is referencing is that back in President Obama's first term, a volunteer on our campaign in a district of 35% Asian Americans turned out not to be who they represented they were. The FBI told me that. We worked with the FBI to help get rid of this person. And Speaker Boehner, who was the speaker at the time when the FBI told me this, was read in on my cooperation and this individual. Devin Nunes, who was the chair of the Intelligence Committee, was read in on my cooperation. And then only because a Trump official, you know, tried to suggest that this was something else and leaked my cooperation, has Kevin McCarthy, you know, out of political vengeance, targeted me. But Molly, Donald Trump had access to more classified information than anybody in the world. And if he could have embarrassed me or shown any wrongdoing, he would have done it. And the FBI, right, in three different statements when Kevin McCarthy started targeting me, have said there was no wrongdoing, only cooperation. And because we removed Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar, you know, for the small infraction of threatening to kill Speaker Pelosi, Joe Biden, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, they want to remove me, Schiff, and Omar out of just pure political vengeance. And so again, it's, as I said, he's going back to something that was in President Obama's first term,
right,
where the FBI repeatedly said, I did everything you're supposed to do, and using it for political vengeance. I don't think that's why they were put in the majority, but he seems to not be able to resist.
So let's talk about this, because I just want to drill down on this a little bit. It seemed like McCarthy was saying, though, that he wasn't going to put you guys on certain committees and that it wasn't going to be taking off of all committees.
So he has said for me, the Intelligence Committee and Homeland Security, for Schiff, the Intelligence Committee, and for Ilhan Omar, Foreign Affairs. And so, you know, we'll see. Again, his members have come out and said, there's a number of them who have said they're uncomfortable with him doing this, because I think it does set a precedent, because if the standard was don't commit political violence or threaten political violence, or you'll be removed from your committees. And now he's expanding it to just using it against his political enemies. Right. Well, there's no end to that. And, you know, I think every Republican in his conference should worry that if they're in the minority next Congress, that they could just be picked off their committees under the new, you know, McCarthy standard.
Right. No, no question. I mean, I also think it's super interesting that that you have this sort of very delicate. I mean, McCarthy sort of won being pro-Trump, but he was still, you know, the people who were against him were also pro-Trump.
That's right. And he gave away the, you know, the shop to get their votes. So, I mean, again, he's allowing them to, with just one member, take down the speakership. Again, he's promised to defund the troops. He has promised, you know, to leverage raising the debt ceiling to get cuts to Social Security and Medicare and benefits that Americans count on. So again, he is, I would say, speaker light. I wouldn't call him speaker. I think speaker light is more fitting.
When you're in the House, everyone just pretends everything's normal, right?
No, I mean, they nearly had a fist fight, you know.
Well, yes, during the, yes. But that was Republican on Republican violence. But I mean, I'm just saying.
What was funny was, Molly, they bizarrely, one of their members stood up and accused us of drinking on the House floor, which, again, it's one of the social chairs of the House Democratic Caucus. I can promise you, if there was drinking, I would have known about
it. Okay.
There was no drinking, zero. But they, again, what we later would find out was they were projecting what they were doing, because the people who were in the fight admitted that that Mike Rogers, who went over to pick a fight with Matt Gaetz, had been drinking. And so, again, it's chaos. It's just chaos on their side. And C-SPAN season two is definitely going to get renewed.
So what are we not seeing? Because you are on the floor and you are there and you're in it. What are we not seeing as people who are on the outside?
Good news is on smaller issues, because the big stuff we have to do is fund the government, extend the debt ceiling, keep Ukraine in the fight. That's all three of those are going to be challenged because, you know, they're the chaos agents on their side. I'm still the chair of the Rare Earth Elements Caucus with a Republican from Pennsylvania. I'm still the chair of the Precision Medicine Caucus with, you know, a Republican colleague to reduce rare diseases and detect them earlier. So on the small stuff, there's still friendships and working relationships, and that will, I think, continue. But on the committee side, you know, the majority of their committee chairs voted to decertify the election, right? So again, that's why it looks like a law firm for the insurrectionists when you put all their pictures up, because they were pro-insurrection and now they have gavels and subpoena power and will litigate the grievances of Donald Trump for the next 2 years.
Who do you think ends up being the next speaker? Republicans have this very, very narrow majority. I mean, if things get crazy enough, there could be, or am I just being way too West Wingy here, a unity candidate?
Look, the unity candidate was Hakeem Jeffries, right? Because he never lost a vote. And, you know, there were Republicans who were, you know, talking to us, moderate Republicans, about possibly switching over or reaching out through kind of emissaries. In one case, somebody approached me about two different Republicans who were interested. And so I think they'll continue to flirt with that. But the reality, Molly, is again, Kevin McCarthy struck this corrupt bargain with chaos agents who have threatened political violence. And so if you extrapolate that out, if you're a moderate Republican thinking about supporting a unity candidate, what do you think Marjorie Taylor Greene or Paul Gosar is going to say about you and aim at you, right? So I'm afraid that when it comes to actually crossing the Rubicon, they look at Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger and, you know, the security apparatus around them, and they think, I don't want to be that. So they just keep their head down. And again, they're the ones that'll pay the price because they're the ones that are in the Biden districts.
Right. You're going to continually have this tension, which is these people can win a primary but can't win a general.
That's right. We're here for that. Because we look at the courts, right? So the Republicans in Alabama, in Ohio, in Florida, you know, they drew these egregious gerrymandered maps where the courts said, yes, these are illegal. We're not going to overturn the 2022 maps, but we're going to look at them in advance of 2024. So we expect there's probably three or four seats that come back to us. So in a plus 4 or 5 majority where they are right now, we're going to get 3 or 4 back. And then, as I said, there's those 18 Biden districts. You know, I don't know if George Santos will run from a Rio jail, but who knows where that takes us.
With Marjorie Taylor Greene sitting next to him, doesn't she get that that could theoretically not be a great look for her?
No. This is him pledging for their fraternity, right? Like this, right. That's what that was.
I mean, amazing stuff.
Everything he said and the fact that he digs in with his lies, that makes him more qualified to be in their crew than less qualified, right? That's what they believe in, is that it's the Access Hollywood model.
Right. You never resign no matter what you do. I want to ask you about this Senate race from California. Already we have 1 or 2 candidates. DiFi has not said what she's going to do, though she is 89. So she would be 95 when her next term ends, which would be quite old. I mean, do you think it's going to be a huge field? And also just tell us a little bit about running in California and what that looks like, because it is the 5th largest economy in the world.
You probably don't remember this, but I did run for president. It lasted a little bit longer than a cup of coffee, probably a grande, but not a venti.
I feel like Brittany may have mentioned this.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. To her therapist. No, I kid. One of our pollsters told me when we were thinking about running for president, he joked. He said, he told me, it's probably easier for you to be president than to be senator from California, because to be president, you just have to, you know, win the first 4 states, Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada. And he said, if you add all of those states together, that's still not even half the size of California. So like California is a state of 40 million people. And, you know, geographically, I mean, it's just, you know, it's so difficult to, you know, traverse the state, 58 counties, I believe. I mean, it's just a big state. It's an expensive state. You have, you know, San Diego, Los Angeles, San Jose, Sacramento, and San Francisco Bay Area media markets. I mean, it's so expensive to run ads, so expensive to, you know, reach voters. And so, you know, it doesn't surprise me that, you know, 2 of the people who are being talked about to run, Katie Porter, who's announced, and Adam Schiff, who it looks like may run, already start with, you know, millions of dollars in the bank, because that's what it takes. And that's why you often see billionaires run in California, because they know that it's so expensive that it's real. It really does make a difference and gives them an edge. Now, all of that said, I've got, you know, I'm friends with Katie Porter, Barbara Lee, Ro Khanna, Adam Schiff, and, you know, most of us right now are focused on the storms.
Right.
And once we get out of that, you know, we'll start thinking about, you know, statewide candidates. Adam Schiff, I've worked the closest with. I don't have to tell you about, you know, how fearless he was during the Russia investigation and impeachment. And I think his words will be repeated for centuries as far as, you know, what he warned about and how, you know, prescient he was on the Senate floor talking about, you know, the duties of the president and Trump's betrayal. I'll wait to make any endorsements until after, you know, the storm season.
I mean, because California is one of those states where the primary vote is really it, right? They don't have really, you know, broad generals the way you do in swing states. So, I mean, how do California primary voters tend to vote?
So I'll couch it this way, Molly. It could be 2 different elections. And first, remember, it's a top 2 primary. And in 2016, Kamala Harris, in the general election, faced off against Loretta Sanchez, another Democrat. So it is very likely that you could see 2 Democrats in the general election. That's not unlikely at all. If there's multiple Republicans running and a number of well-known Democrats running, you could see 2 Democrats getting through. That's what happened in 2016. However, the primary in 2024 is a late primary. It's in June. And so if there is no contested Democratic presidential primary, the voter turnout will be relatively low. That is one factor. If there is a Democratic presidential primary, the turnout would be incredibly high. So I'm sure candidates are thinking about that. If it's low turnout, it skews, I would say, more progressive voters are the ones who turn out. If it's a presidential primary, then you're drawing really a broad base of voters. But I would not be surprised at all if there were two Democrats who make it to the general in this primary, because you're going to be well-funded candidates.
Oh, wow. That is wild stuff. So this Democratic California Senate race could go on and on and on and on, just like the mayoral did in LA.
It will be one of the most expensive, I think, Senate races in the country.
So interesting. Eric Swalwell, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you'll come back.
My pleasure. Thanks, Molly. Of course.
I know you, our dear listeners, are very busy, and you don't have time to sort through the hundreds of pieces of punditry each week. This is why every week I put together a newsletter of my five favorite articles on politics. If you enjoy the podcast, you will love having this in your inbox every Friday. So sign up at fastpoliticspod.com and click the tab to join our mailing list. That's fastpoliticspod.com. Alex Theodorides is an associate professor at UMass Amherst and co-director of the UMass Polling Center. Welcome to Fast Politics, Alex Theodorides. You know, you sent me something. You work at UMass. You do polling. That's your raison d'etre. And you sent me a poll that kind of blew my mind because it was something I've been thinking a lot about. Can we talk about that?
Yeah. So, you know, so at the UMass poll, we run polls periodically. This is not the golden era of doing survey research. But, you know, one of the things we're always trying to get a sense of that I think surveys really can still do for us is give us a sense within certain pockets of which way things are moving, how things are looking. And obviously the narrative coming out of the midterm certainly has been of a Republican Party that's sort of quitting Donald Trump, that has now seen him, you know, all these other things that he did, you know, that those were not enough to kind of leave him in the dust, but costing an election, which, by the way, this wasn't the first election he cost them.
Right. It's the third, right?
Right. But costing an election, that's crossing a line. And so, you know, you're hearing that elite narrative. I've been sort of suspicious of that. So we wanted to see just how much the rank and file have received this memo that Donald Trump is in the rearview mirror. You know, and there's some mixed stuff in there, but generally speaking, I mean, this is not a party where the average voter is giving a stiff arm to Donald Trump. He's not persona non grata among the Republican rank and file. He still leads, if you look at the 2024 way too early numbers, you know, he still gets the most first place votes. What's remarkable there is that Ron DeSantis seems to have become the non-Trump alternative. I'll caveat that by saying that very few people probably know very much, honestly, about Ron DeSantis at this point. But he's in a dead heat with Trump still getting more first place votes and them being essentially tied in a head to head. But if you look at other things, and certainly it's not the case that most Republican voters are unwilling to have Donald Trump on the ballot. He's still a top three choice for he gets the most first place votes. He's a top three choice for most Republicans. If you ask them, you know, why we give them a bunch of possible reasons why Republicans underperformed in the 2022 midterm elections, Donald Trump only gets 10% among Republicans. He's only 10% think he's the reason.
What do they think is the reason?
They think the reasons are the sort of old standby, the greatest hits of rationalizations. Media bias, 30%. So the mainstream media. And then, you know, 21% said voter fraud. Right. So we've got over half of the Republicans, you know, already choosing these things that are basically central to Trump's talking points. The vast majority of Republicans still tell you that Biden's election was not legitimate. After all the work the January 6th committee did, the vast majority of Republicans are still not placing blame for January 6th at the feet of Donald Trump. Instead, they point to Capitol Police. They point to the Democratic Party. Antifa's in the mix there. They do not think Donald Trump should be prosecuted for his involvement in January 6th. They continue to believe the narrative that January 6th was a protest. That's how they describe those events. And that's how they describe the participants as protesters.
Interesting. They've learned nothing from this election.
You know, the truth is it usually takes a long time for parties to learn things because parties are not an it, they're a they. there's a big collective action problem, right? And, you know, Republicans are dealing with that right now. I mean, they, first of all, they created this. Republican elites created this by, even before Donald Trump, sort of kowtowing to conspiracy theorists, you know, being way, way too willing to just allow these kind of conspiracy theories about Obama to build up and fester. And then Donald Trump seized on that. And then obviously they just bowed down to Donald Trump for 4 years and have continued to largely. This is the problem, is now you have this situation where it's going to take a long time for the Republican electorate to catch up to this message, if they ever do.
I think a lot of people are anxious that this is sort of setting the stage for a Republican Party that will not accept election results.
This is the great tragedy of Donald Trump. And this is something that for people like me, I mean, I do polling, but as a scholar, my focus is on partisan polarization. And this is what people like me are afraid of when you talk about partisan polarization. I say partisan polarization because it's distinct from polarization along other lines in this particular way. And I mean, as you know, we've been polarized as a country for forever, for decades. There was huge polarization. You know, your mom faced the polarization with her books. We were polarized, you know, in terms of the feminist movement, the civil rights movement, in terms of Vietnam. There have been massive, massive divides. These divides, until recently, have not fallen along party lines. And that's a key distinction. And what happens when polarization falls along party lines is that elections and democracy become the battlefield. And when that's the case, the greatest fear is that one side or the other will decide to not recognize the results of an election. And that's exactly what we've seen here. It's terrifying. There's a big incentive to do that. And by the way, that's largely what happened leading to the Civil War. Now, I don't think we're on the verge of a civil war, but I do think we may be on the verge of a gradual movement of democratic backsliding caused by this election denialism that Donald Trump has inserted into our body politic.
It's interesting, though. I mean, these Republicans are sort of in denial, right? They don't believe that anything that's happening is real, right? They don't believe that they're losing because of Trump. They believe they're losing because of election fraud and the media and this and that. So, and I feel like it harkens back to this idea that Trump, you know, Trump would say, don't do mail-in voting, but it was ultimately hurting Trump and his people. And I mean, we saw that in Florida. So a lot of us were worried that this would undermine democracy, but largely, it mostly undermined Trump in 2022 and his people.
I do think that their attacks on democracy were important in mobilizing Democrats more than anything else. I also wouldn't dismiss, I think there's been too much willingness to dismiss a related thing, which is the Dobbs decision. I think that had a big impact, especially among young voters, young Democratic voters, in terms of mobilizing them. I think that, yes, on the margins, people choosing not to use mail-in ballots probably stifled some of the turnout among Republicans. But to me, the much larger concern is the fact that you now have a massive part of the American electorate concentrated in one party that you know, just has been convinced that they shouldn't necessarily trust elections. And if it's in their interest, and if it's in the elite interest to deny the results of an election, they do it. We look at January 6th, the events of January 6th, those were horrific. The much more consequential thing, I think, that was happening is that essentially we had a president with a tacit at least support of his party and his supporters just sitting back there pulling on threads, trying to figure out if there was a thread that would let them stay in power. And this time there wasn't. But I don't really want to live in an America where, if there is such a threat, if they did control the House of Representatives, if some of these machinations that they were trying to put into place actually had the potential to work, where somebody does stay in power because they have the House of Representatives as a final backstop, or because, as an even further final backstop, you know, what does the military think? right? What do they have to say about this?
Right. You never want to get to that place.
Yeah, and that's what worries me, right? That we move in a direction where a lot of Republicans would have been okay with that. A lot of Republicans wouldn't have said anything about that. That, to me, is what's scary about January 6th and the whole big lie.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the underlying anxiety that we all operate under. But it is interesting to me seeing this polling. And I want to ask you about abortion because the Dobbs decision, we saw a lot of Democrats overperforming in special elections. And we saw all of these ballot initiatives passing broadly that were pro-choice or anti-choice. But Republicans in Congress, one of the first things they did was make another anti-choice bill. And again, it has no chance of passing. It's merely theatrical. But it does strike me that in order to get the they really have hit a point where in order to keep the base engaged, they have to do things that alienate the mainstream.
Yeah. I mean, and this gives you a window on some of the pressures that Kevin McCarthy and everybody else have to deal with. In our latest poll, we asked what the Republican House should do. And this is, you know, again, after a mediocre showing at best in the 2022 midterms and having a very narrow margin, obviously, in the House. And Republican voters in massive numbers want them to impeach Joe Biden. And not only that, but expect that they will. More than half. They want them to investigate Hunter Biden, obviously, investigate the withdrawal from Afghanistan, we're talking about in the 80s and 90s numbers, investigate the dealing with the southern border. And similar numbers want them to pass legislation that has no chance of becoming law just for the sake of passing that legislation. Only about half said that they should also pass some, you know, compromise with Democrats and Joe Biden in order to actually pass things.
It's so incredibly insane. Obviously, it's not the legacy of Trump. It's the legacy of Reagan, you know, of Watergate, of Nixon. I mean, this is, you know, the Southern strategy. I mean, this is, but it is like Trump was like, why are we disavowing white supremacists when we can just go along with them and that will increase our voters? And I think like we're seeing why you don't want to do that.
Trump basically did away with the dog whistle. You can just say it. And hopefully that's not the lesson that Republicans have taken. But I fear it is that a lot of Republican elites have sort of learned from Trump's example that, you know what, there are no consequences. And by the way, that is another thing that polarization and hyperpolarization brings us. You know, you're not dealing, it makes accountability much more difficult if voters are so divided into these party silos, and they're hearing different media and exposed to a completely different universe of people. It makes it very hard to break through. You really get like an event horizon in terms of trying to communicate.
It's like the Santos thing. You know, people are saying, well, why should he resign? All politicians, you know, instead of saying like this person is morally corrupt or, you know, he's our guy and I'd rather have our guy than, you know. It is curious to me as we're talking about this that, I mean, it seems to me like Republicans are just unwilling to take the pain they would need to take in order to pivot back to center.
It's very hard once you push a party in this direction. They've gone very far in this direction, right? They've purged most of the people who would want to do that. And then you have this group that their whole purpose is not to legislate or anything else. It's to push this. It's basically to serve as trolls of the left. It's extremely hard. And you know, this whole narrative thing, this notion that somehow the party was going to pivot because of one clear loss that could be attributed to Trump serving as an albatross around the neck of Republicans and their electoral fortunes, you know, that's asking a lot. It takes a long time. It took a long time in the 80s, for example, for Democrats to sort of switch course. And the reason for that is that these narratives post-election tend to very much be a Rorschach test. As you said, you know, everybody kind of, and all of us do it. There's always an argument. I mean, Bernie Sanders supporters are still talking about ways in which he would have beaten Trump. And there's this strong impulse to engage in motivated reasoning, to rationalize the thing that you already believed. And so it's very easy to do that in a world where we're only seeing one reality and we don't see all the counterfactuals. And so it's very easy to say, okay, well, in this counterfactual that I preferred, we would have ended up in this blissful place.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. And I mean, that's what happens if you have no sense of like what the mainstream world is like. You just have these siloed right-wing media ecosystem. Can you explain a little bit about how you guys are you working on changing polling to reflect better our new world?
Yeah, I mean, one thing we really want to do is change what we ask of polls more than anything else. And I think that's a big part of the problem. You know, a poll can't tell you who's going to win a 1 or 2 percentage point election. What I always tell people is that it's sort of remarkable in this day and age that polling is as good as it is, because the challenges are incredible. You know, I tell my students that there are two art forms that have really been challenged by cell phones and caller ID. And one of them is prank phone calling, you know, which was a big thing when I was a kid.
May it rest in peace.
And you can't do it anymore. And polling, people just don't answer their phones. It used to be you could, in the 80s, you could draw a simple random sample by randomly choosing phone numbers, and most people answered and you had a really good picture. Now there's so much work you have to do, and it's made harder by polarization. It's made harder by turnout differentials and things like that. So there's just a lot of work that goes in that creates variability on polls, but they still can answer a lot of questions in terms of big movements in opinion, right? Is it most of Republicans who believe that the election was stolen? Not so much is it 51 or 49% that such and such a candidate is going to receive. And also there are things that we can learn about the internal workings of political cognition and political psychology. And so we try to bring the things that we've learned as scholars, which tend to be very different from what's just of interest to the kind of polling groups out there that are doing these horse race polls, you know, experiments and certain batteries of questions, to really get a little deeper while still making it accessible into political thinking, political behavior, political cognition. And I think that's what we think of at the UMass poll as our comparative advantage.
Thank you so much. Very interesting.
My pleasure.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Jesse Cannon.
Molly Jung Fast. George Santos.
George Ponzi Santos.
Schemer. Got another layer of the onion today.
Where did the money come from? Where did the money come from? The Ponzi scheme that employed Rep. George Santos for nearly a year has deeper ties to the shadowy world of the former Soviet Union, not Yugoslavia, the former Soviet Union than previously understood. Is anyone surprised by this?
That would not be me being surprised.
I feel like the Santos thing has gone on and on, but now the question is, where did the money come from? Spartacus wants to know where the money came from. Who among us, you know, it's not all tracked down yet, but it certainly sounds like the guy had no money. And then all of a sudden he's donating $700,000 to his campaign.
Sending money over to Russia.
Sending money over to Russia, involved in all sorts of sketchy shit. And for that, he is and may continue to be the recipient of our moment of fuckery. That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah! And some waves so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that!
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in!
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it!
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Are you spending more time in your basement now that it's your rec room, office, kids' playroom, or home gym? Well, you need to ventilate those spaces to remove stagnant, musty air. For over 20 years, the Easy Breathe ventilation system exchanges dirty, damp air for cleaner, drier, healthier air. Take charge of your indoor air with your own Easy Breathe ventilation system. You can get it installed, or DIY kits are available. Just call 866-822-7328 or visit takechargeofyourair.com and receive 20% off today.